Upshot, multi-world disc golf's podcast about the latest in the disc golf world. I'm the publisher, Charlie Eisenhood. Joining me is Jamie Thomas. Jamie, it is, 4 days until the Super Bowl. Chiefs versus Bucks. Chiefs -3.5. Who you got?
Ooh, it's a good question. The best meme I've seen from the Super Bowl, ESPN reposted it the other day, giving up my declining Star Wars fandom, but it's Yoda and then the new Yoda.
What, the baby Yoda?
The baby Yoda, or like, I think it's a new character. I don't know. I haven't watched Mandalorian yet, but other than that, I'm a big Star Wars fan. And one was Tom Brady. It's just the caption was Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes. Old Yoda, young Yoda. Sorry, I'm messing up the names. The meme was great. But here's the thing. Mahomes is a future of the game. He's just the future. It's like when you watch, we've all seen it on the disc golf tour, right? Like when someone comes out slinging the disc and it's just different. It just looks different.
Calvin Heimberg.
Yeah.
But most recently for me.
I mean, we talked about like Eagles forehand, how he's changed the forehand game a lot. You know, there's plenty of examples, but like, that's how I feel about Mahomes. This is the dawn of the new era of quarterback. And like, if Tom Brady gets this one, he should ride off into the sunset.
It would be pretty amazing. Yeah, it's going to be a very fun game. Difficult to prognosticate a little bit. I mean, the Tampa Bay defense is very good. It's very good. They're going to get pressure on Mahomes. And the question is, can Mahomes just continue to be magical in scramble situations? It's very interesting.
Find out.
I have a Chiefs future, some promotion from back in the day on DraftKings, I think. 55-1, but you could only bet a dollar. But I bet the dollar on the Chiefs. So if they win, I get $55. And I'm taking the Tampa Bay +3.5. I think we could have a very close game. And so I'm hoping to hit the middle, you know, Kansas City 1-point win at the buzzer. But it should be a great game.
Have you been following the developments in the Michigan sports betting?
No, I can't say that I have. I follow the New York, but not Michigan. What's going on?
So I need to do more of a dive into this. I kind of just like had this bookmark to look into more, and I haven't done it yet. But Michigan is legalizing sports betting, from my understanding, and that should, like, you know, maybe it's the domino effect and other states will do it. Who knows? But it's interesting now more that like the states are considering online sports betting in the same way they're considering casinos, like making them a regulated industry. And of course, everybody knows where this is going. When can you, Charlie, bet on Calvin Heimberg?
I know. Well, if you remember, I did a solo show on the Upshot a couple years ago. I think it was right before USDGC. It was either before Worlds or USDGC. It was one of the majors. And there was some obscure site, a European offshore sports betting site that had odds up for the major. And I think here's what I would say. If the Disc Golf Pro Tour wants to have lines on its events and sports betting available, they could make that happen 100%. It's really a question of whether they want to or not. All of these new sports books, because you mentioned Michigan. I mean, to be clear, like 11 or 12 states already have legalized sports betting. You can bet on your phone. You can bet online.
Is it that many?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Jersey, Pennsylvania. I know around me, because I place bets sometimes when I'm in those states. It's not in New York yet. But yeah, it's already on the move. And I think because of the tax revenue issues, I think you could see it. You're going to see it reach most states in the next couple of years.
Call me old-fashioned. I just go to Vegas.
Well, you're so close.
That's fair.
The Westgate in Vegas is a great place to consume some sports and play some bets. It would be great fun to be able to place, you know, bets on tournaments.
One day. One day we'll have the bad beat segment and everything.
Exactly. the three-putt on 18 that costs you $1,000. All right, well, we got a mailbag type show today. We're going to catch up on a bunch of topics that we've been discussing over the past few episodes. A little bit of news up front first. First and foremost, congratulations to both Paige and Grady Hsu, who just had their first child. And amazing, because I don't think anybody knew this was coming.
Yeah, the caption of the photo was surprise. so pretty good timing, I guess, to because we still had a season last season, obviously, to kind of dodge all the camera opportunities and stuff like that. Now that, you know, she's a well-known player and she's going to get airtime. So I guess, first of all, congrats on the baby. Second of all, congrats on keeping it that far under the radar. Like, that's an impressive feat.
That's rare in disc golf, too.
Yeah.
That's rare. But that's very cool to see. I hope they're well. Drew Gibson just signed a new manufacturing sponsorship deal. But you're thinking, wait a minute, I thought he had a mixed bag and he was doing the Infinite Disc thing. Well, he is. He has a new putter-only sponsorship deal with a new company called EV7 that was started by Prodigy co-founder Phil Arthur. And the company right now only makes putters. Now, it's very new. It's only pre-sales right now. But Drew Gibson will be using their disc called the Penrose. It's going to be his signature disc. It's going to be his primary putter during the upcoming season. And the interesting note, you know, we always get just like little drips about sponsorship deals and kind of what is inside of them. Gibson gets a salary. We don't know how much, but it's going to increase 30% year over year through 3-year deal. And he will get a small royalty on every single disc produced by EV7. Not sales on his signature disc, but literally every disc they make, he will get a small royalty. A very interesting deal for Drew Gibson, and we'll see if maybe this can turn him into a top-tier putter, something that probably the last thing in his game that he really needs to work on if he wants to go to the next level.
Sorry to my boy Drew, but you know, there are some memes out there about Drew being the first person to get a putter sponsor solely. but I'm saying that because that's impressive at the same time. I mean, look, Drew's not known for being a great putter. He's known for what he does off the tee, but he does still sign the first contract really of this type with such a spotlight on it in the sport, right? I can't guarantee you that this is the very first contract like this ever, but certainly with a name like Drew's behind it. And it is really interesting that he is essentially the spokesperson for the company with what you're talking about, Charlie, the arrangement where he's going to get a royalty on all discs made. And, it, you know, like you mentioned, or maybe you mentioned this before the show, but if EV7 is going to position itself as a white labeler for other brands, that kind of puts everything in context and makes sense why you want to have somebody like Drew, who's unaffiliated from a major manufacturer, can do that mixed bag, but can find something to consistently throw, right? Because he has the mixed bag, you've got to do something like that on the one hand to make sure that he's always throwing this one putter. And final thought in this about how this is an interesting paradigm. Look at the way Prodigy started and look at the way this started. Prodigy started with a big team, giving a lot of buy-in to a lot of players and pulling from manufacturer teams, right? This takes a guy who already throws a mixed bag and already has these kind of more flexible contracts, only takes one person, but has a stake in the entire company. So I think Phil probably learned something from what he saw go down at Prodigy, and this is an evolution of that type of marketing and association with a pro.
It's very interesting. And, you know, I get the jokes about, you know, Drew Gibson being the guy to get a putter-only sponsorship, but think about it. Who else is going to get this sponsorship? I mean, Drew is the biggest player that could get something, that could get a deal like this. Because every other player in the top, I don't know, 50, maybe 100, has a manufacturing sponsor, a full sponsor. Like, who else is throwing a mixed bag right now? I mean, for a while it was Nico, but now he's Westside. Ezra got signed. I don't really think there's anybody else. So it had to be Drew. And, you know, look at the stats. It's true. He was top 10 in fairway hits, circle 1 in regulation and circle 2 in regulation on tour last year. And he was 51st in C1X putting, below 80%. I mean, that's not horrible, but at that level, at the level that he plays at otherwise, I mean, that's not great. So perhaps this will help him get to the next level. He's, you know, seems to really like the putter. That's what he said. He called it a masterpiece. So, wow. You know, I don't know if that's just marketing, and perhaps, but I'm excited to see how this works out. And I think, you know, EV7 is getting a top player to give them exposure, and we'll see what comes of it. I mean, I think the most interesting thing to me is that we're getting a manufacturer coming into the game brand new, and they're going to focus on one type of disc. We're just doing putters. And this exists in golf. But to this point, we haven't seen that in disc golf. And I think, you know, there are certain companies that have a reputation for having better slots than others. You know, Discraft with the mid-range, Innova with the driver. But we've never seen a company that's just like, we're only going to do one thing. And I think that sponsorships like this, and maybe even companies like this that specialize, could be something we see more going forward.
Yeah, and the interesting thing to me, and by the way, Drew makes jokes all the time about his putting, and put a cap on that. Like, it's not taking shots. Like, he's still a top level player, and he's still, it's not like he's putting up AM2 putting numbers or something like that. He's still a pro level player. But here's the interesting thing, right? We saw this in golf. In the golf industry, this has happened, as you mentioned, and it happened during like the big expansion. Think back to like 1990s, you know, Tiger Woods coming of age and getting his career really launched into the stratosphere. We saw a company like TaylorMade who came into the golf game and focused on drivers primarily at first. But the interesting cautionary tale from the golf industry is I don't know how many of those companies are still independent. A lot of those specialty companies have been bought up by the larger full-range equipment makers. And they still operate them as separate brands. Like TaylorMade is a great one, right? TaylorMade is not an independent company anymore. So it's a tale about where the two sports are. Look at golf and its declining revenues. Look at disc golf and it's increasing. So this could actually be a pretty good anecdotal barometer for how much of a market there is for this kind of stuff. If you start to see more segmenting into individual types of discs or disciplines, you know, putters, mids, drivers, etc. But it'll be a good indicator of where the market is to see if the market will bear that, and will that allow more companies like this to come into fruition, or is this going to be more of a niche play?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think making a golf club is quite a bit more complicated than making a disc. You know, there are subtleties to the engineering of a well-made disc golf disc, but at the end of the day, it's injection molding, and it's not rocket science. Like, if you're a company that can figure out how to make a putter, there's nothing stopping you from making a driver mold. It's, you know, not like just anybody could set up and do it successfully right off the bat. There's a lot of things that you need to control for, but it's also not, you know, milling a piece of steel that has to have all this weight calibration and, you know, I think the specs are a lot more difficult, and obviously the materials are a lot more expensive. So I don't think we're going to suddenly see companies come out of the woodwork and like be like, oh, we're only going to make Speed 5 discs. But I do think that you could see, you know, I think there's room for driver only companies, or like very heavily driver focused companies, as well as putter focused companies, because those discs just sell so well. And if you can convince people to use yours because it's got a great hand feel or a weight distribution or whatever, that's, you know, you can stay lean and small. You can use one machine even and have a small team and still be able to, you know, wedge into the market.
Sure. And that company at the end of the day is still going to run up against scaling problems if they become popular too. So it might be interesting to see if companies like EV7 intentionally go for a niche play or smaller runs or something like that, even if that, for example, could mean a higher price point. Because, you know, like you said, it's still injection molding and it's still, you're still susceptible to all of the same problems that do plague these, let's call them full service manufacturers that make everything from high speed drivers down to putters, when they try to scale up and have a large number of SKUs and a large number of runs, et cetera, et cetera.
And, you know, even companies that do make a lot of discs are in some cases known very particularly for one thing that they make. So like Gateway. When I say Gateway, what do you think of?
The Wizard.
The Wizard. And like, do people throw discs other than the Wizard? I mean, sure, but I don't know them, right? I don't see people throwing. I know people who throw Wizards that probably couldn't even name other Gateway discs.
I bet we get some email about other Gateway discs that are thrown.
And I'm sure there's good discs.
Because I'm curious. I don't know anymore what the other Gateway discs are.
Right.
I know they make them, but again, like you're saying, it's the Wizard or bust.
It's the Wizard. Right? And they make a great putter, and they've made a great putter for a long time, and they're going to sell a bazillion Wizards forever because of that. Anyway, as always, you can reach out to us, upshot@oldtworld.com. And last thing before we get into some mailbag, the PDGA is planning to move forward with Worlds and the majors this season, regardless of international travel restrictions. So as opposed to a year ago, when the PDGA canceled Worlds and came out and said that the primary reason that they canceled was because international players would not be able to come over to the United States to compete, this year they're planning to move forward regardless. So I wrote a whole story. It's up on the website. You can check it out. I talked to some people from the U.S. government, because right now there's a ban on entry from Europe. Basically, if you've been in the European Schengen area or the UK in the last 14 days, you cannot enter the United States. Even if you get a negative test and you follow all the rules, you're not allowed to get in unless you get a waiver. And it's pretty unclear whether disc golfers would be able to get a waiver. Albert Thom actually tried to get a waiver to come over for USDGC last year. He was denied. And the rules, if anything, have gotten a little bit tougher because there were some carve-outs in place under the Trump administration, but the new Biden proclamation doesn't have those same carve-outs. So unless we see some changes, which of course is possible in the next couple months, given that we've seen travel restrictions come and go, I think it's very possible we're going to see majors, that particularly the early majors, U.S. Women's and Worlds in May and June respectively, probably not have players from outside North America.
Yeah, interesting to see the PDGA completely 180 in their thought process in terms of holding Worlds. I'd love to know a little bit more about the decision-making behind that, because it does, to me, on the surface, and of course, you know, this is still the early goings of the year, right? So but it seems on the surface that we try to promote an international game. There's a lot of support for getting a world championship over to Europe and, you know, having more international representation. It's something that I think the fans are in favor of. And of course, it makes the game better. So I guess it's a little confusing to me as a PDGA member to see them give the opposite answers for the exact same potential issue in consecutive years.
Well, let me read what they stated on their website. Added this to their COVID-19 FAQ page. The PDGA recognizes the importance of ensuring that premier events are accessible to players around the world, but in light of the complex and unpredictable status of international travel that is expected throughout the 2021 season, we have determined, out of respect for the significant time and resources invested by the event hosts and organizers, to hold these events as scheduled unless local conditions and public health ordinances prevent us from doing so. We know this may limit some players from traveling to and from PDGA events held in North America and Europe, but we felt it was important to hold these events in 2021, especially since we could not do so in 2020. We are extremely fortunate as an organization to have a sport that can be safely played during this pandemic and look forward to hosting as many majors, Elite Series, and Euro Tour events for our members as possible in 2021. Hmm. So there's the thought process, I think. And I talked to World's Tournament Director Jade Sewell, who, you know, expressed concern, basically unprompted, about the international players and whether or not they would be able to come, but felt that it was important that they move forward, and that having already delayed by a year, having to delay another year would put, you know, sponsorship in peril and just drag it out for that Utah team, which of course already had their event canceled last year, or I guess we could say postponed to 2021 after preparing for probably over a year to hold the event. So I think the feeling is we can't keep waiting. We don't know what the rules are going to be in May and June. We have to hope for the best. Perhaps players can get waivers to come over, and so they're going to move forward.
Yeah. I like the fact that the PDGA is trying to think about tournament directors, because that has been a pain point for a lot of people in disc golf. How tournament directors are treated. Are we cultivating enough talent to go out and like get these big contracts and sponsorships and run a quality event? So that's a positive thing, and I'm for that. But I got to be honest, and this might not be a popular opinion, I couldn't care less about the reasoning, like, we didn't have it last year, so we have to run it this year. That's not an answer to me. That's just not. If it's either a global game or it's not. Like, your eye's either on the ball or it's not. You can't, like, come in with that reasoning, because in 10 years, it's not going to matter if it was 1 year or 2 years missed. Do you know what people all are going to argue about, Charlie?
What's that?
Whether there's an asterisk on the world championship. People still talk about Jeremy Colling's USDGC win and try to bring that up when you talk about US champions. So I don't necessarily agree with the PDGA here that the lesser of the evils is like making sure that you don't go 2 years in a row without a Worlds. I think you would rather, in the long view, go 2 years without a Worlds than bring it back and the majority of fans and media and fellow players feel like there could be an asterisk on a win because we blocked out Europeans from coming. Especially in FPO.
I mean, I think that, you know, if we end up in a scenario in which the Europeans can't come over, I don't think there's any question that people are going to talk about the fact that it may not feel like a true world championship. And does winning that particular Worlds mean as much? You know, I think last year, because the only major was the U.S. championships, and I know that it was a, you know, women's national championship, not U.S. women's, but same situation, more or less. We have single major U.S. championships. Sure, the Europeans weren't there, but it's a U.S. championship. So it feels okay. I mean, in my mind, that feels a little bit more understandable. But, you know, world championships, I do think there's going to be asterisk talk. How can there not be? How can there not be?
You're going to have championships, but only U.S. players can play.
Right, right. And you're going to have three of the top 10 women in the world not there.
Give me a break.
It's a tough situation, and I feel bad for everybody who has to make these calls. And, you know, we talked last year about delaying the event, right? Postponing the event, having Worlds in September. And I think the same logic basically applies this year. I think the PDGA could say, well, we really want to try to hold Worlds, but we want to wait and see if we can and make it possible later in the year. But it seems the decision's been made. I guess that right now we just have to cross our fingers and hope that the travel rules change. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will open up some mail. We're going to talk fourth major. We're going to talk Disc Golf Valley. We got one other topic, which I'm spacing off the top of my head right now.
The fastest growing sport in the country, axe throwing.
Axe throwing, of course. How could I forget? So we'll be right back. It's The Upshot. The Upshot is presented by Pound Disc Golf, makers of the best bags in the sport. You can check them out at pounddiscgolf.com. Get yourself a limited edition Octothorpe. They drop every Wednesday at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. They sell out pretty quick, so you got to set your calendar. Get over there. This week's black and red. They are really nice. So nice. So go check it out and get yourself a pound bag today. Thank you. back to the upshot. We got a ton of mail over the last 2 weeks about axe throwing, Disc Golf Valley, and especially thoughts on the fourth major and the format of the fourth major, the new Champions Cup. So we wanted to dig into that this week. And Jamie, I'll let you pick a topic. Where do you want to start?
Oh, we got to start with axe throwing because the axe throwing community is like turned on to the upshot. We're getting emails about it. So let's start off with Joe. Joe writes in, thanks for the shout out. Joe is one of the guys we talked about on the show last time that was the genesis of the story that went out and played with his buddies. He said he can 100% confirm that they played maybe 10 to 15 total rounds between them when they wrote the blog post. One dude played a bunch of years ago and just happened to have the Vibram disc. So Joe's responding to my inspection of that photo that turned up some Vibram disc and some cloud breakers. So he said they didn't know that they were basically impossible to throw or find at that point and no idea of the resale market. And he said, as for tournaments, he feels like disc golf pays deeper into the pool of players than axe throwing, though that has been a hot topic in that sport. And the prize for first place in each sport are pretty similar. Something that disc golf does that axe throwing doesn't is the different tiers. Joe says he loves that. It allows people who aren't the best to still be able to compete with people around their same skill level. Awesome. Thanks for that email, Joe. It's very cool. Interesting to know that the tournament payout is roughly the same, Charlie.
I agree. I wouldn't have really been able to tell you what I was going to guess. I mean, like, it feels like the kind of thing that could be way bigger or way smaller. I mean, I see axe throwing bars and stuff around now. There's a couple here in New York City. I've done it one time. I'm definitely like 800 rated. It's kind of fun, but to me, it's like worse darts. But I mean, I all respect to those who go out there. And the darts people, by the way, they have big money tournaments. I mean, they have like thousands of fans and people going crazy when they hit the triple 20. So, yeah, we also heard from one of the owners of the Axe Factor in Missouri. And this is from Matt. One of my friends is a listener and shared the podcast episode with us as y'all were talking about axe throwing. We started selling discs at our shop in mid-June, and we are still going strong. We offer a marksman league and even a mini nine-hole course inside. Y'all hit the nail on the head. When the pandemic started, everyone who wanted to do something had to go outside, and disc golf was the best and easiest way to do this. We had a couple guys who played disc golf on the regular well before we started selling discs, and they helped set us up, telling us what players like, what they don't like. As we started selling them, we started playing, and we are hooked as well. Hopefully the trend continues and everyone keeps playing and expanding the sport, just like the sport of axe throwing has exploded across the country and even the world. So there's something going on here. There's like some synergy with the axe throwing folks and the disc golf folks.
I was about to say, is it a hot take that like is disc golf closer to axe throwing than to ultimate?
Yes.
Wow. Wouldn't have thought that a month ago.
I mean, that's a hot take, but I think there's probably more people who play disc golf that have at one point in their lives played ultimate than done axe throwing. But I do think that like demographically, it seems to me from this very incredibly small sample size that axe throwing like is a very complementary game to disc golf, where there's like the people who like to axe throw clearly also like to play disc golf.
Do you think there's like YouTube channels? There has to be, right? Like, I'm asking these questions as if I'd never heard of disc golf and never seen all the stuff that we have in our sport, but like there's got to be YouTube channels where people are talking about axes and I don't know, maybe they like grind the angles, you know, kind of like you can sand or polish a bowling ball, or like weighted heads and lengths of handle.
I think unquestionably.
All right, somebody's got to send us an email. Point us in the direction of the influencers in the axe throwing world. I want to go check it out next time I'm down a YouTube hole. Let's talk a little Disc Golf Valley. We were mentioning this on the show a couple weeks ago. We talked a little about the marketing initiatives and the popularity of the game itself. And Tarver sent us an email, said, I'm a new disc golfer from Ontario, Canada. Just got into the sport last summer. I also just started playing Disc Golf Valley a little under 2 weeks ago. A small point of clarification about your piece on Disc Golf Valley. Yes, you can spend some money on it, but very little, and not in a way that substantially gets you ahead. In contrast to most other games, it is nearly free and almost entirely skill-based. There's something about that, in addition to the very realistic modeling of the physics of flight, that definitely evokes the feeling of playing disc golf. So,
as a casual player, I would agree.
That's awesome, right? That's the thing we were talking about before. Like, you really want to get that feeling. And funny enough, we over at Disc Golf Pro Tour, we had to push a meeting by an hour the other day, and a couple of our guys didn't get the memo. So in our company Slack, they're like, oh, the meeting's been pushed an hour. All right, Disc Golf Valley, here's the code. They just got in and played for an hour until the meeting started.
It's good to know how that's how the Pro Tour employees are using their time.
Hey, you know, tech startup lifestyle, baby.
Well, one of the things we talked about with Disc Golf Valley is, you know, does it influence people in the real world? Like, do they pick up the Latitude 64 discs, which are the only ones you see in the game, because they see them, you know, when they're playing, and then pick one up in real life? Well, we got a voicemail about just that. Let's listen.
Hey, what's up, Ulti World? This is Josh from Daddy Disc Golf. Just wanted to call and touch base. I know I was listening to you guys talk about the Disc Golf Valley thing on the last podcast, and I sell a lot of discs in person and also in my shop, and I constantly use Disc Golf Valley as an example of explaining discs that some players may have never heard of before. A good example would be the Recoil. Just this past week, we were at Glow League, and people were looking through some of the Glow discs. One of the ones was a Recoil, and I was trying to explain to the person, like, you know, what it was like, and I was like, I've never thrown it personally, but I've thrown it a lot in Disc Golf Valley. Three people that were standing around all laughed and instantly told me that everyone knew exactly what we were talking about. So I agree with Jamie. I think 100% disc choices are influenced by something like Disc Golf Valley. So thank you guys. Keep doing what you're doing, and stay cool.
So there you go. He's with you, Jamie.
Wow. The people in the shop just instantly knew what they were talking about. That's awesome. And it just props back to Latitude, right? That's a really smart move. And it's clearly paying off.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised, right? You think about how people discover discs, and it's that they get, you know, their friend shows it to them, or they, you know, read about it online, or particularly because it's kind of like put in front of them because like their favorite player throws that disc. I mean, think about, and we're going to get into this more in our subscriber bonus segment. James Conrad signs with MVP. They drop his volts for sale, and like the website crashes and they sell them all out. And like, it just, you know, as we've seen so much over the last 8 months, 9 months, an anticipated drop of discs comes and they sell out immediately. And so, you know, why the volt now? Well, because it's James Conrad, right? So people have a reason to find out about this disc. Maybe they've never seen a volt before, thrown a volt before, even know anything about a volt, but now they're going to get one because James Conrad. Well, Disc Golf Valley can work the same way, right? You may have never, you get a disc in the game, it flies amazing, you're like, wow, I want to try that in real life. And if you want to give us your own thoughts on this topic or anything else, you can call our hotline and you can get onto the show just like that. 302-448-ULTI, U-L-T-I. One more little, kind of like a combo here. Non-disc athletes. This is from Brian from Vermont. Regarding the non-disc athletes that have switched to disc golf during the pandemic, that's exactly my friends and me. For the last several years, a bunch of us 40-somethings and 50-somethings have been getting together every Sunday morning to play pickup basketball. I love that. That ended with the pandemic, but we were all missing the camaraderie we shared each week. So last summer, one of the guys asked if we'd be interested in switching to disc golf so that we'd have a safe way to replicate that camaraderie each week. Well, it's taken off like wildfire, and now we're all in love with the game. We play multiple rounds per week, even during our Vermont winter, and have already made plans to attend the Green Mountain Championships next summer. When the pandemic is over, we'll certainly play basketball again, but we will also continue playing disc golf. The game is just too much fun to quit on it. Secondly, regarding Disc Golf Valley, count me as one of those people that's taken an interest in Latitude 64's disc as a result of the game. The game got me to learn about their discs, and then that led me to their YouTube channel, which has a bunch of fun and informative videos. I just dig their entire vibe. So now I'm regularly throwing a Fuse, River, and Diamond. I also just ordered a Sapphire and a Latitude 64 hoodie from their factory store. So your assumptions about the marketing impact of that game, which I enjoy greatly, have been very evident with me. And so here we go. This is Brian from Vermont. He's been playing for, what, you know, 6 months? And he's all in on Latitude 64 because of Disc Golf Valley. And, I've heard so many anecdotal stories from guys just like this who picked up the game during quarantine and planned to play for forever. And that's why I think we could see the gains we've seen in the sport this year stick around. Because I don't think it's just a lot of people who are like, well, I have absolutely nothing else to do, so I guess I'll go play disc golf. It's like people being like, oh, wow, I found this game and I think it's great.
Yeah. This is such a perfect email because it's just the confluence of everything we've been talking about. And I love that there's another basketball to disc golf convert in terms of it replacing the activity you used to do, very much like myself. And that's pro move, Brian. Definitely go to the Green Mountain Championships. That should be on your list. It's a lot of fun. But, man, I feel like we got to figure out who at Latitude saw this opportunity and what their influence was to make this happen. Because, you know, it's something that I think more established industries do and have been doing, right? And I think we've mentioned that on the show before. But for Latitude to just jump on that opportunity to take that marketing path, because this is not the first disc golf game that's come out on mobile. There have been a handful of them, and, you know, probably a dozen more than that, but like a handful of very serious candidates, and Disc Golf Valley is really the one that's caught. And to just immediately know that this was the title that was going to catch, or just to have a guess, and to say, hey, this is how we can market our brand. And again, remember Latitude's position in the market compared to like an Innova or a Discraft, obviously. So we got to find out who pulled the trigger on that decision, because it's just, I think it's going to pay off. And again, this is all anecdotal, obviously, like we're saying, but I just think it's going to continue. This is only the first of many. This is the leak in the dam. The floodgates will eventually break, and we'll have all kinds of digital
product placement
way.
Everywhere.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
All right. I think it's time for us to go to fourth major.
All right.
We got a lot of email about this.
Whew.
So we're gonna dig in. Take us away, Jamie.
Okay. Let's start. Like you said, a lot of different responses and a lot of kind of different ways to talk about. So I want to try to find a way to kind of string these emails together in a coherent narrative. So, bear with us while we try this. But I'll just start right here at the top. Brad says, I love what you guys said about qualifying as a champion of some sort for the Champions Cup. I'm not sure how many A-tier or above tournaments exist in total, but the invite list could be only those A-tier winners over the course of the previous year. Could have a banquet type of event as well during the week, I think he's saying, if you want to make it more special. But I feel like it would put a higher priority on winning events throughout the year rather than on prize money or ratings. Charlie, your response to an invitation format to focus on winning in order to get in?
There's appeal. There's no question that there's some appeal. I think there's particular logistical challenges. You know, if you create an incentive structure that tells pros that they need to win, you know, they need to win events in order to be able to compete, then they're going to play potentially fewer Pro Tour and Elite Series events and more random A tiers. And I don't know that that's optimal. And at the end of the day, like, do we want to have a situation where a really great player that happens to have finished second a bunch and didn't win doesn't get to play? I think the challenge is you want to find a way maybe to reward people who have been champions without necessarily blocking out other people from being able to compete. So that's just kind of like my initial take. I mean, I like the idea, but the thing is we already have an invite restricted major. It's USDGC. And so do we want to try to have a second one of those? I don't really know that that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm with you there. That was kind of the first thing that came to my mind, that ultimately if that path is successful, it might draw attention away from your Elite Series events, your tour events, right? So you would have to have some considerations for that. And I think one of the great things about USDGC doing an invite system is that it is a major that doesn't move. So year after year, you're getting invited back to the same hallowed ground where Climo and Schultz and et cetera have won the event, right? Like, I think just one thing to pay attention to is the combination of those two things, the invite and the consistent venue to play at, because those two things in tandem work better than either of those things does alone.
Yeah. There's definitely some more thoughts kind of along these lines of how to, you know, make this event stand out. And I think there's kind of two schools of thought here. One is that you need to make it stand out. The other is that you don't need to make it stand out. And we'll get to that. So let me jump down the way here. This is a maybe even more outlandish concept, but this is from Enzo. I just listened to the last podcast and thought, why don't we have every state or country for outside of the United States select one person that can compete, play X rounds of match play or stroke play? Some bigger countries can have more than one, or you have some sort of qualifier, something like the World Cup process for football. We in Germany have once a year the German Championship, and I know other countries do the same thing. I also know that there are state championships in the U.S. That's true in many states. Based on the membership per state or country, you can send one or more players to the Champions Cup. You will have players that will win more than one state, but my idea would be to give the Champions Cup placements to players that live in the state proper. And that could be another reason to join the PDGA, because then, you know, that's what qualifies you to compete in the state or country championships. Enzo also says match play would be more fun, prefers groups of four players and then having one advance out of each, kind of like a pool stage situation, and then a couple other things there. But anyway, the main concept, states or countries is qualifying players to the Champions Cup.
This is also something that the USDGC had somewhat of a policy for. They used to have invitations for the state reps, the PDGA coordinators for each state. And a lot of the times, I believe, those state coordinators would designate that spot to the winner of the state championship if the state had one. So there was sort of an early version of what Enzo's talking about in place of the PDGA for a few years. I don't believe that policy is still in effect. I'd have to check, but I don't believe they still do that. But and then sort of the Pro Tour uses something kind of like the World Cup qualifier, right, that he's talking about, where you have people advance out of a pool. So, you know, a kind of bookmark way to think about it is hybridizing those two things, having an invite to a pool qualification, which I don't think is necessarily a bad format or system. I do think it can provide some excitement because if you're doing match play anyway, where you're seated in the bracket is always going to be a point of discussion and maybe a point of contention depending on how things work out, right? Like that's just called having a bracket. It's inherent in doing that way. My one issue with this idea, and it gets to, it's the same issue with some of the ideas we're seeing in terms of like how to iterate the format to be more interesting, is that it's not necessarily true that disc golf is deep enough in enough places to have equivalent competition.
I'm going back to New Mexico. I'm gonna get the dub.
There you go. Right. It's about like where you come from, how developed is the scene there. So something like this is probably good a couple of decades down the road if we still continue to see the growth of the sport at this pace, right? To where it can kind of permeate, like even out into the desert, like you're talking about, Charlie, or like up at the top of the mountains. There's probably more mountaintop courses than... ones in the pure desert. But
yeah, so we got another email here that kind of gets to this same idea, but I'll save my thoughts for after reading this one. This one's from Scott. Here's Scott's plan. Invitations go out to all previous major champions, just period, if you've won a major, and all of the previous year's National Tour and Disc Golf Pro Tour Elite Series winners. Then you round out the field with the remaining top players from the tour until you have 70 players. Place players into 14 pools, 5 players per pool. The first 1 to 2 days are pool play. You play each person in your pool in either 9 or 18 hole matches. Then the top person in each pool advances to the knockout round. There are ways to handle ties, and Scott says that he wants to come on the show to explain it. So, yeah, we'll see. Now you have 14 pool winners. The remaining 56 players go into the Sunrise Scramble and play 18 holes, with the top two scores advancing into the knockout round, making it a 16-player knockout round, which starts later the same day. Then you have single elimination 18-hole match play that will take 4 rounds to complete. You could do it in 5 days or tweak it down into a 3 or 4 day event. So that's kind of like a more match play focused style. And here's the thing, like, all these concepts are fun. I appreciate the emails. I think it sound like fun events. Here's my problem. This is not how I want a major to look. I just don't think that these ideas, while fun, do not scream major to me. Does this make me a fuddy-duddy? Does this make me old? I'm 32. I don't know if that makes me old or young or somewhere in between in the disc golf world, but I just feel like we have seen, I always come back to this, right? I watch a lot of other pro sports. I see what golf has done. I see what tennis has done. And I see events that are largely formatted the same way. The alterations are mostly about kind of like environmental conditions, right? Style of course in the case of golf, surface in the case of tennis, and of course, time of the year. And so here's what I wonder. At the end of the day, can you just say, hey, we're doing this Champions Cup, it's going to be a springtime major, and it's going to be stroke play, and we're going to figure out ways to make it stand out that are not format related? Because I just think that all these like crazy match play concepts and scrambles and like, yeah, it's fun. I would love to see events like that, but I just don't know that that screams major to me.
It's not a bad argument. I think the ship may have sailed on the traditional stroke play. Who knows?
Maybe they'll
change
right.
their mind. But here's the real question. Of the emails we've seen, I'm interested to hear whether you think the current format that they are doing and purporting to run with, or some of these alternative and very creative formats, do any of the ones we've seen in our inbox impress you more than what the PDGA is doing? Or would you still say, hey, if we can't have stroke play, the PDGA is the better play, the format that they have decided?
No, I still want to see more of a pure match play. You know, the one we just read from Scott, where you like have a scramble in for the last two spots. I mean, maybe that's a little too much kind of wackiness for me, but you know, a straight match play with pool play to me is preferable to this sort of stroke play match play hybrid, because like I said last time we talked about this, it just feels like a kind of like a worse version of a final nine, which I never liked in the first place.
Right. And the big thing is like, how do you present it to the media? I think that's the hardest thing that people are trying to grapple with. And even some of these creative formats, I still think it's probably a little easier to explain via, you know, your show, your programming about the event as to like what is happening as compared to having 4 rounds of stroke play and then having to like explain that, oh, so now we're going to cut and go to match play. Not that it's complicated to explain. It's just going to, people are going to ask the question, why?
Why is this the way that you did it?
Yeah. Like, wait, why? And that's tough because the answer to the question why is a complicated thing that you can't really get into like on a broadcast or on a media in a presentation format. So that's where the sticking point becomes.
Well,
let's back off some of this other creative stuff. Okay, let's see if 32-year-old Charlie can. Let's see if we have a middle ground here we can reconcile. How about some Stableford scoring? Andrew says the fourth major should use Stableford scoring. Here's why. Part of the reason for match play was for the pros to be aggressive enough on a tough course. From listening to the upshot, this seemed like the number one goal. Attacking a course that is very challenging. Match play does this too, as mentioned on the podcast, but it's not ideal if McBeast, Ricky, or Simon have a bad round and are out on day one. Stableford encourages aggressive play without fear of being eliminated early in the tournament. This format would set this major apart from the first iteration as well. It brings a whole new mentality and playing style that would work well for live viewership across ESPN or CBS Sports or any other major network, and it would mix it up for the players playing stroke play. It would mix it up because the players would play stroke play from there on until the Disc Golf Pro Tour Championship. Stableford also keeps the cards moving and prevents backups because as soon as a player cannot score a point, they just pick up their disc and move on. Unique format for a major. It would speed up play. It would force aggressive play without eliminating the top players on the first day. Stableford hits all of the wickets, says Andrew.
I mean, yeah, sure. Stableford is cool. I want to see a Stableford tournament. I think that'd be sweet. I just don't think it should be a major.
Is it closer, though? Like, you don't think Stableford could pick your word there, but be a major?
I mean, if the PDGA came out and said we're doing Stableford for the major, like, I would probably feel similarly to how I feel now, but I would watch. I mean, I think it'd be, like I said, I think it'd be fun to watch a Stableford tournament. I talked about this on the subscriber bonus segment last week. Here's one thing I will say. If we're going to go weird format, why not just go full-on weird format and have a different format every year for the fourth major? Is that too crazy?
Oh, wow.
So one year you do what they're going to, you know, planning to do for 2022. The next year you do Stableford. The next year you do a straight match play tournament. The year after that, it's invite only for the top whatever players. I mean, you're already making it irregular. It's already going to be difficult to compare it to the other majors because of the format change. So why not change the course and the system?
No, we shouldn't do that, but I like the thought experiment. I'll go one up. We can go crazier. We can just say, hey, everybody go out and play W.R. Jackson, and we will apply every scoring method possible to your scorecard after the fact, and we'll just assign a winner to each type. The match play champion. You're the Stableford champion.
There's 10 formats, and you accumulate points in each format, and then we sum the points, and then whoever has the most points advances to a final match play head-to-head, but then there's also a Stableford at the end.
Have fun with that, U-Disc, figuring all that out.
All right, well, I'm just going to keep it going here. We have some people who have a little bit more of a sense that it should be more traditional, kind of like I think. Frank emailed in, and he just wrote, quote, "All majors in the history of disc golf are dumb because they are only stroke play, said no one ever."
Thanks as always, Frank.
Straight to the point.
I mean, it's he's not wrong.
And here's one from Aaron. I think we need to take in consideration that in the context of a major tournament, prestige building takes years. I would go so far as to say that it's not possible for a major to be prestigious in the inaugural event, possibly even for the first 3 to 5 years of the event. Was the Masters prestigious the first few iterations of the tournament? Probably not. Or at least not nearly as prestigious as it is today. The reason why players want to win the Masters is to have their name enshrined alongside the best the game has had to offer. In essence, because of the history of the tournament. We should create a new major, trusting that it will eventually become prestigious thanks to the weight of history.
That is a completely reasonable, well-rounded thought there from Aaron. Let me modify one sentence he says. He says he would go so far as to say it's not possible for a major to be prestigious in the inaugural event. I would say there's a bottom floor for that. Like, there's a minimum prestige by giving the M designation, right? you're categorizing it by the best. Like, let's put an example for players. You can say if a player is a future Hall of Famer. Like, you can predict those things before they're in the Hall of Fame, and they can be first ballot Hall of Famers. What I'm getting at is, like, you don't have to necessarily have the lens of the look back in time to appreciate. Like, you can appreciate the greatness in the moment as well as in hindsight. And all that is to say, like, because of that, and because we appreciate other majors because of their history, if you give a major designation to a tournament, regardless of format, it's going to have at least some level of prestige. I think that's the sticking point here with a lot of people that aren't really, you know, they're not really vibing with what the PDGA is doing with the Champions Cup, is because they're saying, hey, like, the weakest link in the chain is the strength of the chain entirely. So if you take the history and then just throw this thing in there and it doesn't vibe with the community, like, you're bringing down the value of the major designation. So that's kind of the argument, but I agree overall with what he's saying. And it seems to me when he's talking about the Masters, like, the Masters started out as a very limited event, right? That's one way you can create prestige. You create the limited opportunity to compete and to win, which is kind of like the invitation ideas that we're seeing. And the other way to create prestige is by buy-in and then by proxy, like we're talking about. So if you think of those three things as kind of the controls, limited access, community buy-in, or these days you could basically just call it influencer and celebrity buy-in because everybody's got a social media account, and then prestige by proxy, you've got to kind of figure out which way you want to go with your event in order to build that prestige over those years, like Aaron's saying.
I fully admit that this format that they've come up with could end up being fun, and it could end up being popular. That's very possible. It's just, it's new. It's totally different. And I think that's a little bit risky as a tournament to come out and be like, all right, we're just going to do this like totally untested format. And I mean untested in the sense of combining these two things into one event as a major. And like, this is this new major we're going to come up with. And I think that's why there's been a lot of kind of pushback on the concept. And we got an email from Isaac that, to me, I think if you're going to commit to doing a hybrid style approach, sounds a little bit more like how it should look. Here's what Isaac says. I think this is an excellent start to something different in disc golf. Now, I do think it is only a start, but when you said, you know, what message are you sending players, and then described how match play and stroke play are very different and how you shouldn't combine them, that sealed my thought on why this is a great idea. It is a great idea because they are so different. You might call chess boxing a ridiculous sport, but acknowledging the best player not just at boxing or at chess, but at both simultaneously. In this case, you are calling the top-level disc golfers to be the best with different mentalities. This is true in every single American sport. Make the playoffs and you have a chance. In reality, I hate how many teams make the playoffs in the NBA, 53%, but that is in large part because you play for several months just for one team to have a good month and a half and be crowned the only champion of the whole league. With that in mind, I think four is way too small a field to switch to match play. I love the idea of either three rounds of stroke play and start with a quarterfinal, or two rounds of stroke play and 16 players getting in. To play four rounds so well and lose to someone who may have finished several strokes worse is my idea of the NBA playoffs. But qualifying 16 after two rounds seems reasonable, fun, and will crown a champion who won in a different way than any other tournament. But Isaac has one other idea. What about this? Play two rounds of stroke play, take the top 64 players, divide them up into groups of four using the scores, and then start from scratch, play one round where the top one from each group moves on, making it eight left, then do two groups of four with the top two qualifying for a final. So that sounds maybe like he's suggesting something along the lines of what you see at the Disc Golf Pro Tour Championship.
Yes, I will address that. But I just can't get out of my head, like, Bobby Fischer, knight to E4, and then a surprise left hook.
Oh, bam.
It's like chess boxing.
Have you ever watched chess boxing? It's crazy.
Is it a real thing?
Yes, sir.
Nuh-uh.
Yes.
You're messing with me.
Not. You play a set amount of time of chess. I don't remember what it is, 5 minutes or something. And then you get in the ring and you play a round of boxing. And if you get checkmated or you get knocked out, you lose. Dead serious. It's real.
My YouTube searches are going to look real weird after this week. I'm going to go down the rabbit hole of axe throwing and chess boxing.
You're going to mess up your algorithm so bad.
Oh, man. It's going to be totally... Okay. Back to the topic at hand before I derail the show entirely with that. I love the idea of two rounds of stroke play if you're going to do a hybrid format. Like, I get the argument. I don't know that I necessarily see it the same way because my counter is about contrasting formats being exciting, right? I would still say try it at a lower level. Make sure it works. Make sure you've got a team that knows how to run events like this that can work out, you know, all the little kinks in the system that, like, you can try to think them out all out ahead of time, but you're always going to run into something. So I would say from a team standpoint and a logistics standpoint, it should still be done at a lower level and iron out the wrinkles before it's a major. But I'm not against the idea of, you know, two contrasting things being an interesting pairing. I like Isaac's concept where it's like two rounds of play-in, you know? And I would even go a step further and just say, like, it's not two rounds of consecutive scoring because the idea is aggression and taking the hole when you get to the match play. So when it's the stroke play event, just have your best round. You get to play two rounds or not. You like your first score, fine. You can scratch the second round, right? Kind of like you see in like snowboarding competitions or something like that. You take the best score. So you then seed everybody by the score they put up in stroke play, which is this just them against the course. So it's a good test for what you want to measure in match play, which is, all right, you've got the best scores against the course. Now, how do they compare when you battle? That's not a bad improvement. If we got to have the hybrid, I think there should be more players in the match play and more match play than stroke play.
I 100% agree. If we're going to go this way, commit more to the match play. If you don't want to go pure match play, which clearly they didn't want to fully do, it was considered to do three rounds of stroke play and a cut to eight. And it was also considered to do two rounds of stroke play and then a larger group. But those got vetoed. I would much rather see something like two rounds and then 16 players in, because that way, you know, you're still giving people that opportunity to get those rounds in, and then you'd still probably have to do some kind of playoff in a backdoor bracket for the people who are trying to cash, because you need to pay the top 40%. 16 players is not enough to determine that, so you send the next however many people, maybe you make a cut, and you have them play match play in order to try to win cash, as well as have the top bracket advancing towards trying to win the tournament title. I think that could be really cool. If you're moving away from that because you're like, oh, that's not enough stroke play, then you're tacitly admitting that stroke play is the superior format for a major.
You know what bugs me? There's commonly this struggle between whether a tournament is a competitive venue or whether you're looking out for all of the people who might possibly be somewhat competitive. And, you know, I might be abstracting the point a little bit there, but, like, to me, if you're a tournament director and you're running a major, right? Keep in mind the tier here. This doesn't apply to, like, a C tier. You should be caring about primarily the winner and the challenge and who's going to climb the mountain. Worrying about who's going to get last cash when you're trying to figure out the format for a major, I just think is a recipe
for
disaster. Like, why do you care about that? That's the athlete's job, to try to not get last cash. Like, nobody's on tour, and maybe I'm sounding kind of like what we were talking to Brody about a little while ago, but nobody's out on tour going, man, I just can't wait to get last cash. Go to bed in their van, doing the van life and laying their head down at night by their bumper and going, man, just dreaming of last cash next week at the Pro Tour. It's like, no, you're trying to win. So don't worry about that. If you're getting last cash, it means you have lessons to learn in your game and things to improve upon so that you can hoist that major trophy. But when and if you eventually do, like, don't you want it to be an acknowledgement of the hard work and, like, the most competitive situation you could have been in and you triumphed. That's what a trophy on a shelf should mean, not, well, it was fair for the guy who got last cash and for me and I won it, and so I feel good about that. Like, I don't think Paul thinks about that when he looks at his trophy case.
Well, maybe we shouldn't use Paul as the comparative point, but I agree with your general sentiment here. I think you have, obviously you need to figure out a way that you're going to find the cash line and pay the placements. But that is a secondary concern that you can figure out later. You know, the primary concern should be, what is the way that we make this event the best it can be for the approach to the win? I think ultimately, I would probably prefer if they just made this thing straight stroke play. If they're not going to do that, which it seems like they're committing to having a different format, fair enough. But then let's not do this tacked on match play. Make it a match play tournament. If you want to do two round stroke play and then go to match play, fine. I understand that. Like, you want to give people a chance to play some rounds. Fair enough. I just think that we ended up in this weird middle groundy spot where everybody was trying to, like, the people who wanted stroke play, like, won their argument. The people who wanted match play won their argument, but actually everybody lost because we ended up in this bad marriage, as opposed to, like, really thinking about, okay, like, what's the format that makes the most sense? The one we have, I just don't feel like makes the most sense.
I have a perfect email to wrap up everything that we're talking about here. Just put a nice button on it. Okay. This one comes from Drew. Drew says, my girlfriend and I just listened to the most recent episode, and we had some thoughts on the fourth major. We both love that a fourth major is coming together, but we thought you nailed it when they said they were looking for a way to distinguish a new major. However, a weird format is not the way to do it. Weird is Drew's word, not mine, just for the record. Don't send me emails. This is the first year of a major with a goal for it to remain that way. All precedents will be set, so they can't mess this up with an unpopular and unproven format. Some things that could distinguish this tournament from others could be a unique trophy, thinking back to the green jacket at Augusta, which has been referenced by the PDGA. Another way to distinguish it could be that qualifying, similar to USDGC, but everyone that qualifies cashes. With its outlier location from the flow of the tour, it will make it financially worth it for the players to attend, if everybody cashes that's invited. This is similar to the Pro Tour finale, but use a different way of qualifying, like the previous year's winners of the Elite Series. Just some thoughts, since this is important to the sport. It is of the utmost importance to get it right the first time. And I think that sums up everything we're kind of talking about. Like, there are ways to kind of juice the prestige a little bit and draw interest, but you know, you just have to, we do have to get it right. I mean, the fourth major is something that a lot of people are on the same page on. So it just, like you said, Charlie, it kind of feels like it's in a weird place right now. And hopefully, I don't think major adjustments necessarily have to be made, as we alluded to, maybe just some like mixing of the ratios. But it seems to me that everybody's on board with the major. It's just like, let's get it right.
That is a good point. We literally got zero emails saying it is a bad idea to have a fourth major in the springtime. I think that the number one thing, the number one checkbox that needed to be checked has been checked. So big shout out to the PDGA, Nate Heinold, who we had on, who spearheaded this. That's huge. And I will say this. I don't think it's the end of the world if we have this event one time, you know, in 2022, and it turns out that the format kind of falls flat, and they change it. You know, maybe for a couple of years we talk about that, but in 10 years, is anybody even going to remember? In 25 years, is anybody going to care? No one's going to care. So I don't think it's like life and death that you absolutely get it perfectly right the first time. I'm sure if you go back in the history of golf, there's times when they did weird things or that the tournaments were totally different than they are now, and they've evolved and become different over time. It's not like we're set in stone, right? The USDGC has done some really weird things, right? What did they have that one, like in 2010?
It's like 2011, they were going to alternating years between open flight and performance flight.
Open and performance flight, right.
So there was no open champion in 2011.
Right, I was not really following disc golf at the time, but clearly it wasn't a big success because they bailed on it pretty much immediately. And like, yeah, it's like a little footnote in history, but does anybody really care that much? I mean, nobody's talking about that now.
It's just an interesting piece of trivia because Will Schuster is technically a back-to-back USDGC champion.
There you go.
Right.
And so it's like, it becomes a good trivia game. If they do this and they say, we're whatever, everybody who's complaining, shut up. We're doing this. We're doing four round stroke play and then four people match play. And then let's see how it goes. I mean, I think that's fine. I don't think this is the best format. I think that they could come up with something better. Perhaps they will make a change if the players really push back on this. If they change it later, then people will talk about that and then we'll move on. Of course, let us know your thoughts on any of today's topics or anything that you want to hear about in the future. Upshot@ultiworld.com. Our subscriber bonus segment this week, we're going to be talking about disc demand and drops and the scarcity of discs. We just saw the James Conrad Volts go on sale from MVP yesterday, and it was a bit of a train wreck. But as we've seen, the demand is just off the charts for any of these rarity drops. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Volt drop and what's been going on just around the sport in the last few months. We've discussed this before, but some fresh context and thoughts. So you can become a subscriber, discgolf.ultiworld.com/subscribe. It's less than $4 a month. You get the subscriber-only newsletter. You get bonus content on the site. You get to hang out in the Discord. And of course, you get the bonus Upshot segments. For Jamie Thomas, I'm Charlie Eisenhood saying so long. And we'll talk to you next week right here on the Upshot.
Renew your PDGA membership. We'll see you.